we've mentioned YouTube a couple of times. And I think as I was rereading this Four Myths of Bundling article last night, there's a really interesting line in it about what the perfect bundle is. And I think it's really interesting. He talks about the best bundle is one that minimizes superfan overlap and maximizes casual fan overlap. And everybody should check out this thing. There's some math in there, et cetera. But he actually talks about how the perfect bundle would be at its natural extreme to have 7 billion products, each designed for each person to be exactly what they are a super fan of, all bundled into a single product where you're actually interested in what all the people near you are in a more casual way. So you've nailed every single super fan. Welcome back to Unsolicited Feedback. I'm your host, Fareed Mosavat. This is part two of our episode with Mariah Moscato, Director of Product at HubSpot. In part two, this is a deep dive on Disney+. Disney has faced a ton of challenges over the past few years. They've seen their streaming business stall in growth. They've seen them get pushed by activist investors to make changes to even their CEO and strategy, which thankfully, in my mind, they managed to stave off. But it opened a ton of questions about their strategy with streaming and what's working and what's not working. We analyzed some recent changes to Disney Plus and some announcements that they made to bundle things like ESPN Plus and Hulu into their Disney Plus streaming package. We talk about the shift that Disney is making from being more of a content and experiences company towards more of a tech company and a tech forward company with some of these changes to both their platform and their strategy around streaming. And last, we use a framework called the Four Myths of Bundling, written by Shishir Mehrotra, the CEO of Coda, to break down this bundle strategy and analyze what we think is working, what's not working, and what they should do in the future to both grow their subscriber base and retain their existing subscribers. I hope that this conversation is really valuable for anyone building not just a content business, but really any kind of product or multi-product strategy where you have to bundle different features together to gain the most market share possible. Thanks for listening. Let's dive right in. All right. The next thing that we spent some time talking about before we got here today to record is Disney recently fought off a hostile board takeover from an activist investor around basically their Disney Plus strategy, right? Like basically their streaming strategy. And I, for a while, was apprehensive to touch this topic because I'm not like a big board takeover, finance, Wall Street like person. And which just, this seems like infighting between people with lots of money, et cetera. But as I dug into it, I think it really comes down to a question of product strategy and missteps around the product strategy of Disney Plus. And the more I dug into it, there are a lot of interesting nuggets around this. And I know that you've researched it as well. And the main thing is really one of content strategy. So the next thing that happened is they recently announced that they are going to bundle Hulu into Disney Plus, which looks like a weird move, and also eventually bundle ESPN into it. And then I got thinking like, oh, this is a big shift in strategy. Is this a good idea? And do we think it'll be successful? And so now I'm like more excited about it because it got me thinking about a bunch of different things about how we bundle and share products. So I'm curious about your thoughts about this. Are you a Disney Plus subscriber? Are you excited about this? Let's start there. And then Let's just like dive in. Like, how would you think about building a product strategy around a streaming service like Disney Plus, especially given all the competition that's going on?
Yeah. I'm not Bob Iger, but let me see if I can do my best here.
Very few people are Bob Iger.
Just one guy. I am a Disney Plus subscriber, and I subscribe to every single streaming service. So we'll get to that later.
Okay.
Well, we'll start with Disney Plus.
Are you a cable subscriber?
I got everything. Name
you have
service.
Cable as well?
I got it all.
Okay. You have regular cable and all the streaming services.
I have everything. Okay. Got yes. It. Okay. To answer your question, Fareed, yes. And We should get into that and all my reasons why. Yeah. And how my life is going to be changing in the future because I cannot keep up with the number of subscriptions that I have.
Yeah.
But let's talk about Disney Plus. So I remember back in 2019, I was working on the growth team at HubSpot, and we did a field trip to San Francisco, and one of the offices that we dropped by was Netflix. And we talked to one of the product leaders overseeing the children's department, And it was during the same time that Disney decided to pull their catalog from Netflix.
Right.
And I remember talking to the product leader at the time, and I was like, wow, you must be so stressed out. That must be like a huge part of your revenue source. And she was like, yeah, it is, but it's Disney. And so when Disney takes their catalog, you have to figure out what to do after that. And I remember being like, I don't even know if it's a good idea for Disney to rip all of their content from a platform like Netflix, which at that time had a lot of subscribers. I know there's been a lot of changes since then, since the pandemic, but it seemed like a really good distribution network for Disney. So I really didn't understand the pivot that I think that they took from content to technology. And then they became a technology company. Now, the first few years went pretty smoothly, but they also benefited from the tailwinds of the pandemic, like any streaming service did. And so a ton of people flocked to Disney.
100 million subscribers in the first year.
Yeah, which is great, right?
Yeah.
Is that normal? I don't know. Can they keep up with that? I doubt it. But I also think that they were able to leverage the nostalgia of this generation, right? We grew up on Disney. We knew Disney. And we want more of Disney. And then they have the Marvel Universe. That was a good purchase at the time. I think it's seen its end and we'll see where it goes. But that captured a huge adult audience. What I'm really curious about is how they're going to continue to defend that audience. I am not a parent, and I know a lot about children's TV, and I should not know anything about children's TV. But people talk about Bluey on YouTube like nothing else. Like, parents are obsessed with it because the kids are obsessed with it. And then Cocomelon, I think, is another huge phenomenon. Yeah. Those are where kids are going. They're going to YouTube. They're not going to Disney anymore. They're not going to Mickey Mouse. And then I also think what's really interesting is, how does Disney really defend against YouTube? Kids are growing up on YouTube. They're not growing up on the Disney Channel anymore. And so when is that going to taper off for those who are really obsessed with Disney and the brand? The other thing that we should talk about is the connection to the theme parks. They make a lot of money from these theme parks. Mm-hmm. If you go by yourself, or let's say you brought your family, you're spending 10 grand on a weekend. It is expensive. But that's also where their franchises like come to life. It's a real life experience. They will upcharge you on everything. Literally, it seems to be successful from a park advantage. So when you rip all of your content off every distribution network, your networks or your audience is going to get smaller and smaller. Yeah. Smaller. We're going to continue to see fragmentation across all of these streaming services. Because back in the day, you had one enemy, and that one enemy was Comcast. And you gave Comcast your money, and you had full access to a library of content. I didn't really mind those days, to be quite honest with you. Now, I have 20 separate streaming services that I have to manage separately as a consumer, and I just don't see that working out long-term for any of these separate streaming services. There's going to be consolidation. There has to be. But the big question with Disney is, do they want to continue down high quality, high hit rate content? Or do they want to be in the tech business? If I was them, I would double down on content. I would leverage every other platform for distribution. I would reach every audience member that I can, and I would get that loop going into the parks again and again. I think they're going to lose that loop, and I think they're going to lose the kids' audience. What do you think?
Yeah, so I think this is really interesting because the traditional business model of a Disney-like content creator is we spend the money to find these like high quality creators, et cetera. We develop the IP and we don't distribute it, right? We basically put it out on a bunch of different channels and we drive this wide distribution across all the different channels that exist, right? And I want to give a bunch of credit to Verge podcast that I think we both listened to on this, but also I just for disclosure, I worked at Disney. I was at Pixar until 2007. We were acquired by Disney. I did technically work for Bob Iger. I never met the guy. He was like 50 layers away from me. So there's no real conflict here. But, you know, what we did as creators at Pixar was we created the IP and assets. And then actually, even before the Disney acquisition, all of our distribution was done through their distribution channels through we don't make DVDs and put them in stores. We don't go talk to all the theater owners to get it out the door. We barely even did marketing. We made marketing assets, maybe. We had a very small creative marketing type team that made things like movie posters, etc. But the old business model of movies in particular was make the IP, distribute it through other channels. They pay you for the content.
So you get this big lumpy, like one time, and then a trailing revenue stream of royalties, DVD sales, et cetera, whatever it is, TV contracts, et cetera, over the long course of time. And that you have this spike, you have this sort of layer cake, and then you build the next one. And the ones that turn into franchises, like real meaningful franchises, become sequels so that you can like layer on more on top of that. They become theme parks, they become merchandise, they become toys. For anybody that's interested, there's an awesome diagram that's like a hand-drawn diagram of Disney's business model that I think was made in like the 50s or 60s or 70s, I don't know, early. I think it's maybe even drawn by Walt Disney himself, I'm not sure, that you can search for. Maybe we'll put it in the show notes, that sort of describes this, where at the center of their loop is content creation. And then it leads to merchandise sales, theme park visits, all kinds of other things around it, around the ecosystem. I think what's interesting is that the streaming model is like in direct opposition to this in some respects, because you're like, in order to grow my streaming business, I need exclusive content. And so I think they tried to apply the old model of franchise building into the streaming model, which I think worked at the beginning. We'll put Pixar movies on Disney Plus, and the Pixar audience will flock to Disney Plus because their kids want to watch Cars. We'll put the Star Wars franchises exclusively on Disney Plus. The Star Wars audience will flock to Disney Plus. We'll do that with Marvel. But I think the huge mistake that they made was that they leaned in hard on those existing franchises, thinking it would grow the audience. And I think the mistake was, what it does is it helps engage the people who are there, but all the Marvel audience was already a Disney Plus subscriber, all the super fans. And I use that word specifically for a reason. All the Pixar people were already there. So it used to be that you spent this big upfront cost because you got paid every time a piece of content came out. So think of it as new revenue acquisition. But in a subscription service, if that content is solely consumed by people who are already on your platform, you're basically spending a ton of money to retain a customer who may have already been retained anyway.
Right.
Whereas a smart strategy has a mix of acquisition-oriented content and retention-oriented content. And I think they were spending like it was acquisition content, but only getting retention, if retention at all. Now, there's a lot of arguments that they overdid it, made too many Marvel properties, made too many Star Wars things. And I think that's probably true. But that maybe would have been fine if each one wasn't really expensive to produce. And so what I think is super interesting is they've pivoted pretty hard. And now they're like, the way we're going to grow Disney Plus is we're going to put Hulu on Disney Plus, or we're going to put ESPN on Disney Plus. And my initial reaction to this is, that looks really weird. These things are totally different. But the more I thought about it, the more I got bought in. And the reason I'm bought in is, one, the old strategy wasn't working. You've got the whole Marvel universe already on Disney Plus. You're not getting anybody new by spending a ton of money there. Now, you do still need to put stuff out, but maybe you do it a big bang stuff a couple times a year to get people excited and stick around, but it's not bringing new people onto the platform. And it reminded me of this article that I read recently, a long time ago, that kind of blew my mind, called The Four Myths of Bundling. It's written by Shishir Mahotra. I hope I got his name, the pronunciation of his last name right, who's the CEO of Coda and was at Google and I believe YouTube for a very long time. And he lays out these four myths. And the one that I think is the most interesting is the fourth myth in this context, which is, he says, myth four is that the best bundles are narrow and have very similar products, so they make sense to consumers. And this is exactly the mistake that I think Disney Plus made with their content strategy. It makes sense. We want kids, so let's do more kids content, more Marvel, more Pixar, more things that look and feel the same. And his claim, and I'm curious about your thoughts on this, is that the reality is that the best bundles are ones that minimize superfan overlap and maximize casual fan overlap, is what he says. And now, sorry, I've been talking for a while, but I think this is worth explaining, is that his thought is, there are super fans. There are people who will come to your platform and pay incredibly high prices. They will pay the full bundle price just to get the super fan thing. Think about a Star Wars person. They will literally spend, especially if it's exclusive. So this is where it's at odds with what you were saying. If it's exclusive, I will pay whatever it takes to see every new episode of the new Star Wars show because I am obsessed with it. But minimizes superfan overlap. So what's the most opposite you can think of is, I don't know, college basketball playoffs, March Madness or whatever, which also has these super fans. They will pay whatever it takes. I pay for ESPN Plus for literally three things a year that I have to watch and want to see. Every featured group stream of the Masters, like I will pay whatever it takes to get that and I will get it and I will pay for it. But that also has casual fan overlaps. The people who watch sports also like Star Wars, but they're not super fans of it. So now your bundle is basically getting every super fan, but it's retaining because they're casually interested in the other stuff. What I think is interesting is Netflix knows what they're doing with this big time, and they spend accordingly. Whereas like Disney went down the super fan like bundled route and kind of missed that. They're now spending tons of money on things that aren't acquiring customers. So that was a long rant, but this, it's really an interesting product framework. Think about it, because it really is counterintuitive.
Yep.
Your first thought when you see Disney Plus is now ESPN, Hulu, and Disney is, how the hell are you going to market that? And it turns out it's probably the right bundle.
Let's talk about the super fan, the casual fan, because I do think that is one of the most critical parts that Disney did miss. Because you're right, a super fan of Marvel is going to show up. And a super fan of Star Wars is definitely showing up.
But they're the same people.
We're the same people. Yeah.
There you go.
And they're already retained. They already love Star Wars. They're not going to decide not to like it. Although I know there was a few releases in there people weren't super excited about, right?
And they flooded it too, right?
Yeah, 100%. But they're missing on the casual fan. And I'm assuming with the move with Hulu, that's what they're really trying to capture, is that more passive audience. But also what Netflix is really good at is high volume content. At the end of the day, people just want to watch something on TV.
Right.
And Disney does not have the velocity of content creation because they want to have such a polished brand, which we like about them. But that is also going to do them a disservice. But let's go back to, let me use my own example. So you used a sports example.
Yeah.
And I agree with that. I'm going to use a Real Housewives example.
It's a great
one. That's my super fan. Okay. Yeah. So why am I still on cable? And that is reaching the end of its road, let me tell you. I only used cable because I wanted to watch The Real Housewives on Bravo. And then last year when Peacock and like Paramount Plus TV carved out like the recording part of the streaming. So for example, I can watch it live on cable, but if I want to watch a rerun, which was part of the syndication back in the day, there was first run syndication and rerun syndication. Yep. And rerun syndication is where you get a lot of your money, right? Because you want to watch shows when they didn't air live. So for me, I'm always watching things after they've already aired. I'm watching them later. And one day I show up to Comcast On Demand. I go, I want to watch The Real Housewives of Salt Lake City because I saw a clip on TikTok that was blowing up. And I was like, I got to be a part of this franchise. I've watched New York. I've watched Beverly Hills. I've watched Orange County. I've watched them all, right? Atlanta. But I haven't watched Salt Lake City. So I go to watch the first episode and Comcast is like, no. You got to download Peacock or whatever the streaming service is. I can't even remember which of these programs are in which streaming service because some of them just have such a weak brand and I cannot remember. And at that point, I was like, why am I paying for cable? I'm not going to watch things live. I'm going to watch them on a re-recording. And if I can't watch any re-recordings on demand, which used to be what on demand was all about, watching something after it had aired. Now you can't do that. You have to go download a different app.
Right.
And so now I'm outside of the ecosystem. I'm not using cable anymore. I'm going to cancel my cable service. But what did I end up with? I end up with 20 separate streaming services. And I just don't see there being any path forward where someone, whether it's Disney, I don't think it's going to be Netflix, has to consolidate these networks because I don't need 20 subscriptions. And at the end of the day, I don't think Disney wants to have the content engine of low quality, low hit rate content that Netflix has. And this is referenced in the Verge article. They want to have a really polished brand and they don't want to dilute their brand. And if they don't want to dilute their brand, but they want to be in the streaming service game, they're going to have to attach other services for passive viewers or for casual fans to capture their attention. Because I will say, after I finished, I binge watched all of The Real Housewives of Salt Lake City in 2 weeks or something like that. And then after that, I was like, I don't need this service anymore. I'm going to cancel it because I'm a human being who doesn't need to pay for this. But if someone can just bring cable back, bring back all my channels, but those channels are now applications, and bring them together in one service that I can pay one person to do, then I'm back on board. I just don't see there being any path forward that is outside of consolidation. Can you challenge me here?
I think this is really interesting, because when we were all paying for cable, it was like the frustration was like, I can't believe I'm paying money for this thing that I don't even use. And it turns out you actually weren't paying for that. So the interesting thing here, there's another myth here, which is that you should pay out revenue to content creators or to individuals in the bundle based on their percentage of usage. And that makes a lot of sense, right? You think about it, you're like, oh, if I watch a YouTube video, then this is how Spotify pays out, right?
Yeah.
They pay out basically by saying Taylor Swift gets the most listens, she gets the most rev share. But his claim here is that you should actually pay out. And this is an idealized world. This is hard to measure, but basically pay out based on the marginal churn contribution. And I think cable actually did this. So the dollar amount that they paid ESPN for a cable subscriber was huge. It was like a very large percentage of the overall cable bundle price, and the whole Disney package, whatever you call it, ESPN included. But that's because if you take ESPN off of my cable, I'm guaranteed to churn. There's a huge number of super fans, as he calls them in this article, who would immediately churn. So if 10% of your subscribers would churn if you remove that piece of the bundle, then 10% of the revenue should go to that piece. Now, what we've done is we've unbundled this into a bunch of different pieces, and now each thing has to stand on its own in terms of churn. So in my mind, the answer to the churn problem is a broader bundle. Like, cable showed the way on this. And the reason is because when Game of Thrones ended, I churned off HBO because I was on HBO just for Game of Thrones. It may as well have been a transactional purchase. But I didn't churn off Amazon Prime because Amazon Prime has a ton of stuff. And even better, I get bundled free shipping, which looks ridiculous on its face, right? Prime is actually even better than cable because you get discounts, you get free delivery, you get one day delivery, you get all these other benefits, including your streaming. And so just because it's not the right content mix today, I'm unlikely to churn. So I do think you'll see consolidation. I think Disney's really smart here to be like, we have Hulu, we have ESPN Plus, we have Pixar, Marvel, Disney. If you think of each of these as separate brands with their own really strong audience of super fans who are interested in that other stuff. I watch Pixar movies and I watch golf on TV. That should lower churn and drive acquisition as they add new pillars to the piece of the puzzle. And so the question becomes, can you match your content cost to your pricing and to your sort of like overall business dynamics?
Yeah.
And I think Disney's just in a really hard spot there because just like the music business, they like used to make $1 jillion in free dollars from building these things that like lasted a long time, et cetera. Like, the Cars movie probably generated many billions of dollars of revenue over the long course of time through all of the different channels. And now it's like a piece of a bundle that costs a couple $100 a year. And that's very different. Like, it's the same as music. Like, I used to buy 30 CDs a year, and now I pay for one Spotify subscription. So it's tricky. It's going to take time. I think they're being unfairly maligned around this. I think they made huge mistakes. But this really is a hurry up and wait problem. Like, Spotify, the streaming business is big now. It took decades to match it. And so there's this innovator's dilemma problem around it. So I think it looks weird. And I think they have a product marketing and positioning problem around Disney Plus as the name. But if they can land it, I think they're in a really good place to be the high-end provider of content across a bunch of different verticals in a way that drives real retention.
So back in the day, you had a cable provider and it was one enemy, and that enemy was Comcast. And so you got to be all mad at one person, and that was Comcast. Now we have 20 enemies. So I'm not really sure who to point towards. But back in the day, what was frustrating about Comcast? It was expensive. Your bill went up every single year. You had to relitigate it every single year. It was a big mess of a process. People didn't like the customer support.
Yeah, basically a monopoly in most
places. It was a monopoly. You didn't have a choice. And I think that was a big issue as well. And people didn't really compete with them as much. So you really only had one choice. At the end of the day, though, it was a cost issue. And people didn't want to keep paying more every single year. What are we seeing now? When Netflix was first introduced, what was it, $5 a month? It was insanely cheap. It was a no-brainer for everyone to use Netflix. And then and we can get into account sharing and login sharing, but even without that, they've been increasing their price every single year like clockwork. And I know this because I work in pricing and packaging. So I do track what everyone's doing in the market in terms of increasing their prices because it is a sensitive area. I checked before this podcast and I'm paying like $40 a month right now for Netflix alone. I have two additional members on my account with me, just two. There's three of us. We pay $40 a month. And I have 10 other streaming services and cable. I am paying way more as a consumer than I have ever paid to Comcast in my life. And that used to be the competitive edge of streaming. It was so cheap because it was streaming, right? Now, especially because of the pandemic, these are public companies. They had high growth in the pandemic, 2020, 2021, 2022, and then you started to see that fall off. Public companies, which means they have to show revenue growth quarter after quarter, year after year, which means if they want to show that growth and they don't have the content engine to support it yet, what is the easiest lever for them to pull? Pricing and packaging, specifically pricing in this use case, which means they're all going to increase in price pretty dramatically over the coming years. And at that point, I do think they're going to have an even tougher challenge of retention. Right now, I think they are still pretty pricey and you're going to see a lot of retention issues. You've seen people flooding out of Netflix, right, for that very reason. But I still think that Disney is going to play a role in that high quality space. How much are people willing to pay and how much of that bundling are they going to get as a result? I work a lot in bundling. HubSpot is a bundle on a bundle. And we talk a lot about bundling bias. So people don't want to pay for things that they feel they're not using, right? And so what is our job? Our job is to really expand their consideration set. And I do think recommendation engines, especially within content, have gotten really good over the years. And some places do it better than others, right?
Of course.
Netflix, I think, is a stronger recommendation engine than Disney Plus right now. But Disney Plus doesn't have that depth of a category yet. But I do think when they start to think about their bundling strategy with ESPN, with other services that they might acquire, with Hulu, they need to expand the consideration set for those passive viewers because they already have on lockdown those super fans. They need to move away from that audience that's always going to be locked in to Disney. They need to expand their audience if they want to win more hearts and minds. And then I still don't think that we've gotten into the YouTube problem.
I want to get there in a second on the YouTube thing because, and we're leaning really hard on Shear's article here. But before we get there, I think it is worth noting, and I found this really interesting in a recent interview with the head of Disney Plus. He talked about how moving Hulu onto the platform wasn't just about putting the content on the platform. They redid all the encoding, fine. They did a bunch of metadata work. They created a new platform for all this stuff. And I was pretty surprised by this, if that makes sense, because I think what it signaled to me is that they want to solve exactly the problem you're talking about. They want to get really good at recommendation. They realize that a broader bundle requires the platform to be more effective in terms of catalog, merchandising, recommendation, all those sorts of things. And they probably realize they're going to have a variety of different formats. So long form films, TV, shorts, etc. And if they're going to have all this stuff, they need to be a tech company. And this is a big risk. It's huge. Disney's one of the oldest companies in the world, one of the most successful, one of the most enduring. And really, I think the pitch they're making here is Disney Plus is Disney. There is still the parks. There is still some of this other stuff. But we are moving to this is the primary distribution platform. And that means we have to be way more of a tech company. And they've been layering this for a long time. I believe they bought Major League Baseball's like tech arm to do all the streaming technology it was called BAMTech a long time ago. Turns out Major League Baseball was like one of the leaders in doing streaming, live streaming back in the day. They have brought their own content on there. They're pulling this, all this stuff. So I think it's a huge bet. It's a really big bet. I would say the alternative is sell their content to every other platform, but that effectively is the same. And here's why.
Why is that not a winning strategy? Because that's what I would have recommended. Just use every other channel as distribution and put all of your money into content creation, which they're excellent at.
I think it's because the willingness to pay for content from other streaming providers is only as the marginal return contribution of the subscriber that it creates. And so I think that's a really highly diminished value from those other places. I think they see the writing on the wall, like the music business, which is selling content to platforms without any customer relationship and ownership is a diminishing returns game, because like we're willing to spend less on content. So of course they will be too. And that's what I think. And so I think the distribution problem in order to build these enduring franchises is a bigger one. And let's talk about YouTube, because, and you also mentioned the TikTok shorts, distribution is changing. Like the way Real Housewives gets out there is not by being on the right channels. It's like by having other ways to distribute that content, right?
Right.
So one alternative is they get distribution by selling their content to every other platform. I think that's interesting, but could have long-term risk, which we've already talked about. The other option is try to drive the highest distribution possible on Disney Plus and their properties in an owned way. And now the tricky thing here is if it's your business, you have to charge a lot of money for it, the full price of the bundle, but that also keeps people from using it. So I think the question that we're asking here is, should Disney Plus be free or monetized in some other way in order to drive distribution and make sure the parks, the franchises, the merchandise, everything is accelerated in that original diagram we talked about?
Yeah, that's an interesting thought I hadn't explored. But working for a company like HubSpot, the free angle has been very successful for us in distribution and acquisition and being able to get more people exposed to our brand and what we offer. And so I do think the core question is, how does Disney make money, or how does Disney want to make money? If their core revenue stream is not streaming, sure, make it free. But I still don't know if that solves the challenge of acquisition because of their content library. I'm still worried about their ability to churn out as much content as the other competitors, specifically Netflix.
Yeah.
I also just think that the people who are stickiest on that platform, like we already discussed, are already bought into that brand. I'm more worried about long-term, what is the next generation of Disney fanatics or folks who like Disney content, whatever that's going to be in the future. And I still don't think that those folks are in the ecosystem today. Those people are young people. They're even earlier than Gen Z, and they're not in the Disney ecosystem.
Right.
And I'm not 100% sure how they're going to be brought into that ecosystem if they're largely living in other ecosystems like YouTube, which is free or really cheap for some of their paid offerings. It also depends on what does Disney want to be. They're not just for kids, and we know that, right?
Right.
But if you were going to focus on the children's division, really compare that to the days of Mickey Mouse, they don't really have the next generation of Mickey Mouse. Right. And so for the next 10 years, I think they'll be fine. I'm a little bit worried about the next 20 to 30 years if they can't get the young population hooked on Disney, just like we were hooked on Disney growing up. And that does come down to distribution. To the high friction upgrade experience, it is expensive to use Disney. And if their catalog is not expansive, it's going to be hard for people to stick with that platform and justify it when there's lower cost offerings that crank out way more content, like YouTube. YouTube is a bottomless pit of content. There is nothing you cannot find on YouTube. And when you have no money, you're going to go to YouTube because it's free to use. But they also do have high quality children's content that people are already hooked on. Right. And I don't know if Disney is producing the same level of for the children's division. They have the adults, I think, on lockdown, those super fans. And Disney has been a long-term enduring company, like you said, Fareed. But I'm not sure they're seeing around those corners of what is the next phenomenon for Disney. Is it the existing properties that they have? Do they invest in new properties? Do they just acquire properties and be the distribution engine themselves? I'm not sure what the answer is, but for the free question, it really comes down to how do they want to monetize? Yeah. And I'm not sure it's just through the parks alone.
Yeah, I think, look, like this model depends on net new franchises being created that are either acquired, which is what Bob Iger did for a long period of time, buying Pixar, buying Marvel, buying Lucasfilm, et cetera, or by being internally created, by building new franchises, new ideas. So within each of those verticals, you go from Incredibles to Cars to Toy Story, et cetera. And in the old days, you could build a sequel and acquire new people. You like make money again, make more dollars from the same person. In a subscription model, you do need to keep enduring the franchise for retention, but you need net new super fans, new people who are not otherwise attracted to your platform, who do not exist on Disney Plus, in order to acquire new people. If you look at Netflix, I think they do this really well. They have customized content for different countries, for different places, and so that when they land in a new country, they can acquire new people. They have all kinds of weird stuff. And then they have a bunch of cheap garbage that's just like ways to keep me engaged, retained, and not want to quit, right? My best example of this is the like silly game show about, like, is it cake or whatever it is?
Yeah. Is it cake? It gets me every time.
Yeah. So that costs them nothing to build, and it just drives some retention. It's there. It makes a wider library. So what are those net new franchises? My concern is actually a creative one. It's not clear that there are like net new franchises that they've been creating. Pixar's kind of stalled out on new stuff, on non-sequel things that have been big hits, high quality films, but that haven't been like blockbusters. And it is very tricky because we don't have the cultural concentration of movies dropping in the theater that everybody goes to see that like drives that kind of behavior. So I think that's a concern. That said, they're going to buy and acquire and layer more stuff. So maybe Disney Plus will look more like a cable bundle where I can watch a basketball game, ping pong, or whatever is the casual version of that, along with a Pixar movie at the same time. On the free side, you're already seeing this from Netflix. They have an ad-supported tier. I think that's probably even more important for Disney Plus than it is for Netflix, because Netflix isn't trying to monetize outside of the subscription, whereas Disney is. And with the on the kids side, it's probably even more important to be able to make it really low friction and easy for parents in particular. Their kids stuff is more like enterprise software. There's like a buyer and there's an end user, and it needs to appeal to both, right? And the beauty of Disney content is it does appeal to both. Whereas like some of this YouTube stuff, the kids really like, but there's like a lot of brain rot stuff that like parents that's on YouTube.
I don't know if this was covered in the Verge article too, is like the dilution of the brand that is known as Disney. Is Disney willing to dilute their brand to bring in some of these more like low cost TV offerings? And I hope the answer is yes, because I don't think the Disney brand needs to be associated with every piece of content that they have acquired.
Yes.
I think that they can preserve that brand for their in-house creations. And that's why I think maybe Disney Plus, even the positioning, isn't going to work long term. But I am on board with Disney acquiring more services so that the consumer also can just use one subscription and still have a variety of options. Like you said with ESPN, obviously a very sticky audience. I, as a consumer, am on board with that. But I do think there's a question of like how associated with the brand is all of the subcomponents.
Yeah.
And they need to sort that out. I certainly do not care. I think there's obvious things, like you said with Pixar. Growing up, it was very clear back in the day what was a Pixar-generated movie versus a Disney-generated movie. You could visibly see the difference. And yes, they were obviously positioned differently. But then when they're brought in-house, there's still a high-quality grade that they put on both of those things. But they can preserve that high-quality content, in my opinion, over here. And then they can also tap into those more passive audiences, which they need in order to grow that business. And then the last thing I don't think we've covered yet is, if anyone's going to consolidate the market, they need a lot of money. And right now, who has the most money? It's going to be Disney.
Probably.
I don't think the other services are going to be able to compete. And again, I try to look at it through the end user, consumer. I think the business angle is obviously very interesting, but I don't see any way out where there's not going to be consolidation, because all the streaming services are getting very expensive. And as they increase in price, the retention is going to flop out left and right from every single service. And the only one that's going to survive is someone who offers enough variety to the audience and enables them to stick long term.
Yep.
We don't want to churn out. I don't want to go through that Hulu cancellation flow. Have you ever seen it? It is the worst cancellation process I've seen in my life.
Yeah.
And I know this is a public podcast, and I'll say it to their face, because they're really good at keeping customers, right? There's like a 6-step process. Every CTA is, are you sure you want to cancel? Don't you want to keep Hulu?
Boo.
And it's like, okay, maybe I do. But if you say you're Disney, right? And let's say that's maybe not a good experience for the customer, but it's effective at reducing churn. Do you want to be the next Comcast, the next person who's really hard to break up with, not because you don't want to break up with them, but because you're forced to use that platform because there's no other options.
Yeah.
That I would be worried about in full consolidation, though I don't think a full consolidation is on the table.
Let's talk about, we've mentioned YouTube a couple of times. And I think as I was rereading this Four Myths of Bundling article last night, there's a really interesting line in it about what the perfect bundle is. And I think it's really interesting. He talks about the best bundle is one that minimizes super fan overlap and maximizes casual fan overlap. And everybody should check out this thing. There's some math in there, et cetera. But he actually talks about how the perfect bundle would be at its natural extreme to have 7 billion products, each designed for each person to be exactly what they are a super fan of, all bundled into a single product, where you're actually interested in what all the people near you are in a more casual way. So you've nailed every single super fan. And as I read that, I was like, it's not quite 7 billion, but this sure as hell sounds like YouTube, because there is, for every subgenre of thing that you could possibly be a super fan of, not just one, but many high quality creators building in that niche, in almost every single thing. So my YouTube recommendations right now, we share it because it's on the TV, et cetera, is car reviews, because I'm like, was shopping for a car for a little while. And oh my God, is there a world of people known with obsessed creators details. With all the details of every single car.
That is the most helpful videos I've seen.
Super awesome. Doug DeMuro, high quality guy, really weird vibe, but like all there. Yep. I have a ton of golf type YouTube stuff. I've got a ton of skiing content that my son, who's super interested in, has been watching, et cetera, down the line. For every single person, if you ask them, what are you obsessed with? There's a channel on YouTube for that. And on top of that, there's this big, broad-based Mr. Beast type stuff too. And if you look at it, and then you hear about the stuff with kids, Bluey or Kokomo, I don't even know these things because my kids are too old. There's also like a whole set of, I don't know, my kids make fun of it because some slang term kids use, skibbity or whatever, skibbity riz or something. Their skibbity toilet is like one of these like brain rot, stupid, like auto AI generated, like kind of goofy video things that he calls iPad kids watch or whatever. Yep. So anyway, there's every single piece of the stack. And it's like almost as close to the 7 billion products bundled for 7 billion people in a single place of any product in the world. And it's got to be a huge threat. The same way TikTok and short form video is a massive threat to YouTube. So each step down is like sucking from the others.
And I think YouTube has a pretty defensible position at this point in the market. So I don't think anyone's really going to come for them. The amount of content being created there in user-generated content, which we really haven't discussed yet.
No.
This whole myth that we desire high-quality, polished content, I think we're seeing that diminish over time.
Yeah.
Obviously, for those big theatrical releases, we want the primetime content. But in terms of everyday watchers, they're looking for a lot of user-generated content. In terms of bundling, I don't even know what YouTube's bundling strategy is.
It's everything. It's literally have everything. And use recommendation to make sure each person gets exactly the piece of the bundle they care about, right?
And I don't feel like they're leaning into that enough, because I do use YouTube. I don't feel like I get the best recommendations. But if they were to really polish that up, I could see them really offering more enticing bundles than anyone else, because they have the library of content to back it up.
Yep.
They have a lot of passive viewers and passive content. You can just put on the TV when you're like doing dishes or doing laundry, which it's like kind of 50% of watching, right? It's not like engage, attentive watching. Right. People are half paying attention and they don't really need high quality content for that.
Yeah. And you're seeing them go in the other direction. To the point, should Disney Plus be free? If you think about YouTube's model, is YouTube is free and ad supported. Yeah. And actually very successful in terms of monetization. Like, by the way, never visit a car website. All you get after that is car ads, because they're like, oh, we can optimize the retargeting budget because the amount of money we make if we convert you is so high that we can.
I was going to say, the ROI is so high.
They just flood the space because their bids are higher than everybody else's. It's just like everything on the internet is the same freaking car ads for a little while. It's the same way, like once you touch a piece of furniture on Instagram, it's all your ads are furniture ads. Anyway, point here was it's free and ad supported. And then they have layered in the family tier and the subscription tier to have no ads, premium features. They are starting to launch YouTube movies, which is you can watch movies on YouTube. They have probably will eventually have premium channels, like these kinds of things. They own that audience and they can pull it in. Now, I think they would love for Disney to put its stuff on YouTube.
Yep.
This is this sort of impasse where honestly, a lot like this is a really weird analogy, but remember when we were building RunKeeper and every single fitness app company thought they were going to be the platform that connected all the fitness app data. And everybody was in this impasse where we're the platform. No, we're the platform. No, we're the platform. It turned out nobody was the platform and nothing won, right? And the companies that were deeply successful were the ones that actually didn't focus on the platform side. They just said, let's go all in on consumer experience and make the best thing ever. And Strava still exists and a lot of these others don't. MyFitnessPal still exists, et cetera. Actually, in some ways, went for the bundle strategy. I think it's the same with these folks. Everybody's trying to run the table and no one's letting anyone else run the tables. What's going to happen? And I think we'll end up with 2 to 3 players left. Probably, you know, and one of them is quietly YouTube, is the point.
And I'm like, I don't care who wins out, but I would really benefit personally from 3 of them and 3 of them alone winning out. That's good for consumers. But I will say, along the Disney angle, we didn't touch on this, but they were so focused on taking their content out of ecosystems. I don't know if they were as focused on leveraging other phenomenons in the ecosystem. Again, I don't watch Bluey, but Bluey is massive for the kids audience, but they can't license that because they're not going to give any of their content to YouTube and they're not going to give it to Netflix. And I think that Netflix isn't the best at building brands, but they have a few brands.
Yeah.
Again, this is alluded to in the Verge article around Stranger Things. And I'm not someone who wants to go to a Disney park ever. So I am like the more interesting audience for them to win over. If they were to bundle their services with parks, but also they were able to license phenomenons from other ecosystems like Stranger Things, like Bluey, like Cocomelon, they could pull that into their ecosystem.
Sure.
But I think that they've largely been focused on pulling their content off of other ecosystems. Yep. And maybe that was the right choice and it seems to be doing well so far. But the bi-directional thing I don't think has been explored as well, or even just being able to leverage and license other people's very successful products. And then I also want to get back to what you said on YouTube getting into movies. I almost said, because where did you go back in the day? If you wanted to see a clip of a movie or you wanted to see like a rerun of a movie, YouTube would be the place to illegally watch that, right? Yeah. And they've cracked down on that. But I also like to look at natural human behavior. Where are people naturally going to do a thing, right? And then how do we match the product strategy to that natural human behavior? It makes sense that YouTube would get into the movie game because back in the day, they were hosting movies, again, illegally.
Exactly.
And it was user-generated. It wasn't supposed to be there. But that's how anyone would discover movies if you weren't willing to pay the premium price.
Yeah, they've done an incredible job of, again, productizing existing emergent behaviors on their platform. Music videos were a big thing, and people would listen to music on it. Now they have a YouTube Music, right? Yep. And they figured out the rights and are dealing with the streaming, all that sort of stuff. I believe YouTube is like the number one place music is listened to. I don't know. There's like crazy stats around that. They're doing that with movies. They have done it with adding subscribers, channels, these kinds of things. So they've done a wonderful job of it. And YouTube TV is, we haven't even talked about, that's sort of a separate thing. I would say that's just like recreating cable. It is just obviously the biggest, like a true umbrella brand and wide bundle that doesn't own any of its content. And so they can be this sort of Switzerland like location. Yep. I think the interesting, just to get to the positioning piece, the hard thing for Disney is Disney means 2 things. Disney is the umbrella company of all these other brands, but Disney is also Disney,
right?
Meaning Disney branded content. And so it will be interesting. I don't think they should do the HBO Max change, which I think was one of the dumbest rebrandings of all time and maybe too early, but eventually it might need to be for Disney. They either need to convince people that Disney, the brand, is also ESPN, ABC, Bluey, whatever they acquire, Marvel, Pixar, etc., or they're going to need a new umbrella name for this service. And both of those are hard jobs.
And I also think that a step towards consolidation is aggregation, right? If someone could just aggregate all of these streaming services and I'll pay for them separately in one place, that's at least a step forward for the consumer. And there is a lot of shared content that can take place in that environment. Yeah. We haven't talked about Apple TV at all. And Apple TV also means a couple things, right? There's the device, it's Apple TV. There's Apple Plus, which is really the streaming service. And I think what I'm about to talk about is Apple TV. I inherited one from my friend Matt. Thanks, Matt. And what it does is it aggregates different shows that I'm watching across different services and surfaces them to me. And I'm like, thank you. Someone is aggregating the stuff that I'm already watching into one place. So I have a landing place for all my content.
Yep.
That to me is also a step forward for this consolidation of where can a consumer go to gain access to all this different content? And there can be more cross-sells in that environment, but there's no ecosystem that's doing it super well today.
Yeah, I have a Chromecast that does similar, which is nice. Yeah. I think Amazon's model of having subscribed channels on top of it is a lot like old school HBO, Cinemax, Showtime, et cetera, as premium additions to your cable bundle is doing that. I think this begs the question, okay, if Disney is going to be a tech company, what should they do? And I think this is an interesting point, which is they probably need to get more comfortable putting licensed or non-Disney content into the Disney Plus platform. They need to identify how to get more low-cost programming to drive retention and casual usage. And I think they should continue to build their own first-party content that is exclusive, just like Netflix does, at the head of the spear for these big franchises to develop and add new lore to them, et cetera, to try to drive monetization across the other things. So I don't think they can ever be a pure tech company. But I think if Disney Plus is at the top of it, at the tip of the spear for all this, I don't see how they can first party develop everything. It's just, it's not economical. They can't go spend many billions of dollars acquiring new content by acquiring new pillars over time. They have to figure out how to either license or pay other people to build stuff or become, to be fair, have you watched Disney Channel ever? There's a lot of low quality shit on the Disney Channel.
I was going to say, back you know? In the day,
like, it's got to ladder up to these high quality tips of the pyramid, but there can be a lot of other stuff. And I think that's what we're seeing with this Hulu ESPN bundling thing.
And I think there's got to be a little bit, I don't know about this, but it is a hot take episode, but more give and take. If Disney is not willing to license any of their brands, it's going to be hard for them to pull more into their ecosystem. But if they were a little bit more flexible, it doesn't have to do with everything. It could be like the top brands or even like the middle ones, middle grade. That could at least give someone something as a carrot to bring them into the ecosystem.
Yeah.
And if they wanted to start to aggregate some of those services together, they're the brand to do it, but they'd have to give a little to get a lot.
Yeah, I think the answer there is probably looks a lot like what they used to do with windowing and vaulting and that kind of stuff in the old days. So like, you know, Bambi came out every 20 years in the theaters or whatever it is, right? It would go from one place to another. So maybe what happens is there is the equivalent of the DVD window where a new Pixar film is available on, it is already for purchase, just to be clear, but could be free on Netflix for a 3-month period. And that could serve both things. Now, it's a little tricky because does Netflix want that on there if the goal of it is to drag you over to Disney Plus? But I think there might be an opportunity to do maybe free, you know, YouTube movie distribution or whatever it is to some of the more independent platforms as a way to do acquisition so that these new products can be shown and seen to non-Disney Plus subscribers on other places and then pulled back in. So that might be a good without hurting the long-term retention by windowing it. So it's, oh, if I want it all the time because my kid wants to watch Cars 50 freaking times a day, like then I get Disney Plus. But if I want to see it for the first time, I could see it somewhere else. Recreating the theater experience, maybe that's part of what they could do. I don't know.
Fareed, let me ask you this question. If there's going to be three winners in this game, who are the three? In your mind?
So I think Amazon is going to always do this because their broader bundle of Prime is just like the world's highest value. And nobody gives them 100% any crap for the profitability of that because there's so many profits everywhere else that it doesn't really matter. And they don't have a legacy business that's like declining to zero that they're trying to rebuild. So they do not have an innovator's dilemma, et cetera. Perfect. So I think Amazon, we haven't even talked about it that much. I think they're in a good place with Prime Video.
Yes, I agree.
Their content kind of stinks. Just to be clear, but
it's really hard to sort through. They have a couple hits from that, but you're right about the subscription bundle. That's going to keep people there for a very long time.
Yeah. I'm bullish on Disney and Disney Plus. even though I'm not a subscriber, which is super interesting.
I'm shocked.
The minute they bundle ESPN,
you're in. Yep.
I'm in. And that's because I want Disney Plus. There's a bunch of stuff on there I want to do, watch and be able to see. But I'm not a super Star Wars person. I'm not a super Marvel person. I'm like interested and will watch, but I would never pay that price per month just for that. I will go if it's around. I will be excited about it. But I don't have a super fan draw. Pixar movies are another aside, but I see them in the theater and that kind of thing.
I was going to say, they still have the theatrical releases. So you're missing on a little bit of the game, but not the full game.
And my kids are older, so we missed it. I do actually think their bundle strategy will pull me over. I'm close, but not quite there. And then I think all the Peacocks, Hulus, Maxes, all whatever that shit, not Hulu, all the little one-offs, Paramount, all that shit, they're all going to die.
I think this is
exactly like everybody's trying to be the mega app and no one's going to win. They have to be bundled to be successful. So I think 100%. They probably have three, Amazon, Netflix, and Disney. I think Apple sticks around, but it's like its own weird thing. Their goal isn't to make a ton of money on content. It's to sell more fucking phones. So I think it's just, I think they, like Amazon, have this like weird aside, but I don't think it'll be huge.
Yeah,
so I think those will be the three mega ones. Okay. And then I guess we have YouTube.
See, now you have too many choices.
I have too many choices.
Who are you going to drop? You got to drop one of them.
I'll drop Netflix.
I would have dropped Netflix too.
Yeah. I think Netflix's content strategy, I have been more and more, I'm like very close to quitting Netflix personally. And I think it's exactly the problem that we just talked about, the opposite of the Disney problem, which is they just have not nailed any franchises. That there's no super fan stuff on Netflix anymore.
I agree. And they're really struggling to turn that corner. So at some point, they're going to have to find an exit strategy. And that exit strategy might involve Disney.
It might. Or they have to they need whatever the next Stranger Things, House of Cards, etc. They need these cultural phenomenons to stay relevant. And they have not done it well recently, as far as I can tell. And they're under a lot of pressure to spend less money on content acquisition. So I think it's
really,
I think so. I think profitability for all these companies.
Oh, is like paramount right now. I completely agree. And that's what's going to actually be how they fall on the sword.
Yeah.
Is trying to keep up with the demand of the last couple of years, which is unsustainable.
Any activist investor was just going to suck this company dry, right?
Sure.
Disney needs to be owned by the core Disney people. It isn't exactly the family anymore, et cetera. Steve Jobs' family still owns something like 10% of Disney because of the Pixar acquisition. So there's still a pretty closely held set of folks, and I'm glad they pushed it off, because it would be a real shame to watch this thing get picked apart by private equity and just sucked apart. So
if they want a worse retention strategy, that would have been what it was.
I think that's right. All right. That was a super fun conversation. Thank you for joining us all the way from Dublin, Ireland here, Mariah. I know it's late for you. So that was great. Talked about dating. We talked about Disney.
I know. From dating to Disney, really cover it all.
And that wraps our episode of Unsolicited Feedback with Mariah Moscato. As always, I solicit your feedback. Do you have any feedback for us? Please join us in the conversation on LinkedIn or sign up for our newsletter at unsolicitedfeedback.co and feel free to reply and tell us what's working and what's not working. Next week, we'll be joined by Claire Vo, Chief Product Officer at LaunchDarkly. Thanks so much.